deja vu. This moment's happened before.
You have found the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Hello, and welcome to the Kaleidoscope Gallery. I'm your host, Paul Edwards, and alongside Kaleidoscope Gallery contributors Dave and Leah, we will be exploring the spirit of alcoholic spirits, the once-banned spirit absinthe and its fabled psychedelic effects, tequila worms, moonshine bootleggers and their association with stock car racing, the prohibition and the rise of the secretive speakeasies, scotch and the power of peat moss, rum runners and pirates, gin and its history as a medicine and current connection to hand sanitizer, and the possible botanical parallel between alcoholic spirits and cannabis. So let's step into this exhibit, inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery. So we're talking about liquor here. And I actually found that there's a number of interesting stories when you dig down into different types of liquor and their histories and some of the rules surrounding them. But basically, this is according to Wikipedia. Liquor is an alcoholic drink produced by distillation of grains, fruits, vegetables, or sugar that have already gone through alcoholic fermentation. We've got a whole bunch of types, though, don't we? For example, we have rum. Now, you enjoy rum from time to time, right?
A rum is one of the most beautiful. The fine rums, or the Demeras, are one of the most wonderful spirits, made from pure sugars, not messing around, distilled in an oak barrel. I find that rum, if it gets aged more than 5 years, becomes too sweet. But, or maybe 7 years, okay, 8 on the outside edge. But once you're into the 10, 12-year-old rums, it's just like an after-dinner treat. But if you want to drink rum, you want to drink 5 to 7-year-old amber rums and Demeras. They're fantastic drinks, yeah. And some beautiful rum, so from around the world.
Interesting. Well, you were right about the sugar cane. So it's distilled sugar cane molasses, and it's aged in oak barrels, which we just said. Interestingly enough, the Philippines is the largest producer of rum globally.
The good rums are some of the best liquors in the world, and the bad rums are some of the worst liquors in the world. And the same goes for tequila. Mm-hmm. The good ones are unbelievable, pure, and just almost like drinking water with the fire of the agave. But the worst tequilas will just melt your insides and hurt your brain and make you never want to go near tequila again. So many people are like that because they'll have like, oh, tequila poppers. Or if you need like a lemon and some salt after tequila, you know you're drinking poison.
Although tequila dates back only a few hundred years, people have long used the heart of the agave plant to make delicious alcoholic beverages. Cultivated from at least as early as 200 AD by the Zapotecs of the Oaxaca Valley of southern Mexico, the maguey, also called agave and the century plant, has been an essential plant in the region for well over 1,000 years. Today, many credit Jimmy Buffett and his song Margaritaville with ensuring tequila's place in the pantheon of America's most beloved spirits.
Okay, so tequila is a distilled beverage made from the blue agave plant, primarily in the area surrounding the city of Tequila, northwest of Guadalajara, and central western Mexican state of Jalisco. So the red volcanic soils in the region of tequila are well suited for growing the blue agave. Mexican laws state that tequila can only be produced in the state of Jalisco and limited municipalities in the states of Guanajuato and others. So they have these strict rules about where you can, what part of the region of the country you can make it in.
You want to go on a tequila tour?
What do you mean?
Like this winter, let's go to Mexico and go into the blue agave fields.
Yes, I would love to do that, actually.
And then drink the sweet fruit. It's a vegetable? Fruit?
Well, let's see, it's a plant. Let's see, agave plant. I would have to say it's a vegetable. Or, yeah, it looks like a vegetable anyway.
It's definitely not an animal or a mineral.
That's for sure. Check this out. Planting, tending, and harvesting the agave plant remains a manual effort, largely unchanged by modern farm machinery and relying on centuries-old know-how.
So in your studies of alcohol, have you found any evidence to support the very different intoxicating effects of the different kinds of alcohol, even though it's the same drug effectively?
Yes, that's a great point, and it's true, isn't it? Different liquors seem to have different effects, even though they are, as you say, the same. They're just alcohol, ultimately. But I suppose this is probably an answer that's based in chemistry, ultimately. But I can say, personally speaking, that alcohol liquor made out of fruit, for me, is a less pleasant experience than liquor made out of wheat or grains, like bourbon.
Is bourbon the correct pronunciation?
I don't know. Actually, people...
I would say bourbon.
Bourbon. What do I say? Bourbon?
Bourbon. Now pitching for the New York Mets, Pedro Borbo.
Have you ever seen a tequila with the worm? Like a worm inside the tequila bottle?
I've not. I think that is a mezcal thing. Is that?
Here's a brief history of that worm in the bottle. See, mezcal gets confused for tequila a lot, but while mezcal can be made from 250 different types of agave, tequila has to be at least 51% blue agave. All tequila is mezcal, but not all mezcal is tequila, and only mezcal has worms. And even that is technically false. It's actually not a worm, but a moth larva that lives in the agave plant. Everyone notices the crazy guy drinking from a bottle with a worm. Sorry, a larva. And no, the worm doesn't have any hallucinogenic effects. You'll still need some magic mushrooms for that.
Well, what else would you find in the bottle? I don't know, maybe a frog?
They're like a newt. They're basically saying amphibians are best tequila floaters. I thought that the idea of the worm was that it had some psychedelic property.
Yeah, I guess that's just nonsense, apparently.
But maybe not. Depends what worm they put in it. Like the ones for export are probably just like the same worms they use for fishing. But the ones they keep are the ones where when you eat the worm, you have a totally crazy trip and you're like seeing Tweety Bird and dancing on the rooftops.
You ever tried absinthe?
Yes. And absinthe is a powerful treat. I might even have a bit. I
thought absinthe was banned.
Well, not anymore. It's back. It's back, and it's better than ever.
Absinthe, the green fairy that supposedly makes you trip balls. The spirit that was banned for almost 100 years. First things first. To get absinthe, you need wormwood. By the end of the 19th century, absinthe was all the rage in Europe, especially in Paris. The artists obviously loved the green fairy too. Pablo Picasso, James Joyce, Van Gogh, Oscar Wilde, and Ernest Hemingway, just to name a few.
Absinthe is an anise-flavored spirit derived from several plants, including the flowers and leaves of the wormwood,
They say that the Impressionist era was built on absinthe because it just made the blurred vision. But I don't know about that. But I can tell you absinthe is a powerful drink filled with legend and psychoactive properties.
Check this out. Absinthe originated in the canton of Neuchâtel in Switzerland in the late 18th century. It rose to great popularity as an alcoholic drink in the late 19th and early 20th century France, particularly among Parisian artists and writers. The consumption of absinthe was opposed by social conservatives, partly due to its association with bohemian culture. Then they just name drop all the badasses that were drinking absinthe, like Ernest Hemingway, Van Gogh, Oscar Wilde, Pablo Picasso, Edgar Allan Poe, Aleister Crowley.
Mr. Crowley, what they done in your head? Clearly the answer is absinthe.
Absinthe has often been portrayed as a dangerously addictive psychoactive drug and hallucinogen. The chemical compound thujone, which is present in the spirit in trace amounts, was blamed for its alleged harmful effects.
I think that's pronounced tahones.
So it was banned. By 1950, it was banned in the United States and much of Europe. Yet it has not been demonstrated to be any more dangerous than ordinary spirits. Ah, bummer.
Well, as we were previously discussing, each spirit has its own particular effect, and the effect of absinthe is clearly intense and stands on its own in ways that I haven't experienced with most liquors. So I had a crazy experience with absinthe in Lebanon. We were visiting Beirut and
You had a crazy experience?
My first experience with absinthe was in my old building on Adelaide, the Lagerland USA, where we had our jam sessions. And we had these neighbors who were animators. And they played with the dark arts and the stop motion arts and the parts of the arts that induce having a bottle of absinthe. But they pulled that out.
And you can get this at the LCBO, the liquor.
You can now. It was banned at the time. Now you can get it. Yeah.
So, okay. So this is fairly recent that it's been unbanned.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it's dead.
All due to exaggerated claims about its hallucinogenic properties. However, you've tried it and I haven't.
You've never tried it? Oh, well, I was... Every time I've tried it, I don't know whether it was the cachet of it or like its particular recipe. Or, you know, which absinthe has an ingredient that isn't a worm. And people get confused with tequila, but it's called wormwood. And it's a special herb that when it combines somehow with the anise licorice and the, you know, extreme proof alcohol, that it produces a almost psychedelic euphoria. Where you're not sure where you are or who you are, but you know exactly what you're saying. But it's not words you ever thought of. It's words that are being funneled to you by that list of names on that you read earlier. Proust and, you know,
Oscar Wilde. Eric Satie.
Absinthe. So I'm visiting my sister in Beirut, and she sets me up with this dude, David, who wanted to like show us around Lebanon, and he drives us across to some beach because I was like, I just want to go swimming in the Mediterranean. So I go swimming, and then on the way back, he stops at this place called the King's Shawarma. And you figure, well, this is like the king of Lebanon shawarma. It's got to be good fucking shawarma. And we go there, and he's like, oh, well, right next door. And this is not even that late in the day. Right next door is my friend's bar. Let's go eat our king shawarma there. By the way, the king shawarma had french fries in it. So we go over to the bar next door, and the bartender's so happy to see David that he comes to the table and he brings out a bottle of absinthe. And we start drinking the absinthe. And then he's like, I want to give you, everybody had hashish there. So he was like, I want to give you some weed. And like, no one had seen weed the whole time we've been there. It's just been like balls of hash everywhere. So we drink the absinthe, and then we roll up the weed. And then, like, in Lebanon, at least at the time, drinking and driving was, like, the way to go. Like, everybody was drunk, and nobody would stop at red lights, and just a fucking shit show. So I'd kind of gotten used to my driver being drunk. But in this case, my driver was drunk on absinthe. And also lit up the weed in the car, and he wasn't used to it because he's been on the hash for so many months. And he's driving on the highway, but he's driving really slowly, and everybody else is just like regular drunk and just got
Today, there are nearly 5.7 million barrels of bourbon aging in Kentucky. To be considered a bourbon, a whiskey must adhere to a specific set of legal requirements. It must be made in the United States, aged in new, charred, white oak barrels, must be made of at least 51% corn, distilled at 160 proof or less, and barreled at 125 proof or less. And lastly, there can be no artificial coloring or flavor additive beyond water. If those rules aren't met, then it simply ain't bourbon.
I had just refreshed my cocktail. What is it? Bourbon. Not bourbon. Bourbon cocktail.
I don't know if I'm right. I call it bourbon. Yeah. You call it bourbon or bourbon. Bourbon.
Bourbon.
It is the American whiskey.
American whiskey is distilled from a fermented mash of cereal grain, and bourbon whiskey is made from a mash that contains at least 51% corn and aged in new charred oak barrels. It's corn liquor, and it's not allowed to be more than 80% alcohol by volume. But can you imagine 80% alcohol by volume bourbon? That would be insane.
It's some strong fucking corn. It's all corn?
Well, corn and rye. Corn whiskey, so just made out of corn, is usually unaged and is sold as a legal version of moonshine.
More than three centuries ago, American bootleggers made corn whiskey by moonlight to avoid being detected by the tax authorities. And so this whiskey became known as moonshine.
And we know that, yeah, NASCAR. Which is the National Association. What the hell is that? It doesn't matter what it is, but anyway.
It's a lot of fast cars going round and round and round.
NASCAR was born out of the people who would transport illegal alcohol, corn whiskey, moonshine, across the southern states, became extremely fast drivers at tweaking their cars so they can get even ever faster to outrun the cops.
Really?
Yeah, and slowly but surely that evolved into car racing.
During Prohibition from 1920 to 1933, bootleggers had to run moonshine without getting caught, and that meant building faster cars.
Well, you have to change the engine, build it up a little.
And as the custom cars became faster, the drivers wanted to know whose was the best.
Some of the moonshiners got to bet who had the fastest car. And it was a cow pasture, something down in North Carolina. And they got to racing around through this cow pasture. And that's how the race really got started. They got to drawing crowds of people.
Those hometown races are the earliest roots of NASCAR. Some of the most well-known drivers to come out of Virginia have roots in running moonshine.
And, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard, which is a television show from the 80s, is loosely based on this idea.
When you're talking about that, I was thinking about the Dukes of Hazzard. Uncle Jesse. Just good old boys. Never meaning no harm.
Just a good old boys. Never meaning no harm. Beats all you never saw. Been in trouble with the law since the day they was born.
Yeah, it was kind of implied that Uncle Jesse used to be a bootlegger.
Fast-driving bootleggers rolling cross-country in Prohibition. That's how, like, half of Canada was founded. Like, Seagram's, the Crown Royal, the Montreal Expos. It's all like, liquor smuggling money. Because we didn't have that same Prohibition, so we were send liquor to the States left, right, and center.
Yeah, it's true. I grew up in Windsor, Ontario, across from Detroit, and it was a hotbed of bootlegging. And right up till, you know, the 70s or 80s, they were pulling out old 1920s cars because the cars would race across the frozen Detroit River. Sometimes not always make it.
Mm-hmm. So were the cars still filled with liquor?
Perhaps. Moonlight and Runners is a 1975 action comedy starring James Mitchum about a Southern family who runs bootleg liquor. It was reworked 4 years later into the popular television series The Dukes of Hazzard.
Y'all set a spell, because I want to tell you a homespun story about homemade whiskey and some down-home folks just trying to earn a dishonest living.
I know you hag boys, moonshiners, troublemakers, and trash. Well, you clean moonshine out of this county.
Moonrunners is a blockbusting story of car chasing.
Hold it right there.
I did the music. I'll tell you the story. I'm Waylon Jennings.
It focused on moonshine-running bootleggers using fast cars to elude federal agents. And its soundtrack reflects the outlaw music boom of the 1970s. And that was Waylon Jennings as the balladeer.
There's nothing better than outlaw balladeer. Like, if I had an outlaw balladeer in my circle of friends, I would open up a tavern immediately.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
U.S. Prohibition, 1920 to 1933. The growing temperance movement in the 19th century and the Anti-Saloon League had argued that drinking alcohol was damaging American society. Prohibition began in the United States in January 1920, after the 18th Amendment became effective, making the manufacture and sale of alcohol now illegal. Even though arrests for drunkenness initially declined, the law was very difficult to enforce as public demand surged for illegal alcohol. Bootleggers found inventive ways of manufacturing and selling liquor. They created homemade moonshine or bathtub gin and smuggled it into cities and bars. Some bars became speakeasies. In order to sell illegal alcohol, they were secret. Because of the shared problem of prohibition, all kinds of people from different sections of society gathered in them. One such group that owned many of the speakeasies and profited from the prohibition were organized crime groups. Many Americans never wanted the law, and prohibition agents were too few in number and easy to bribe. As well as this, it was clear that crime had risen rather than decreased before alcohol was illegal. In February 1933, Congress passed the 21st Amendment, ending prohibition.
Don't
So, Leah, how interesting would it have been to go to a genuine speakeasy during Prohibition? The secretive nature, the risky nature of consuming a banned drug, the jazz music, the mingling of classes, races, sexes, liberated women, and open-minded men. What would it have been like?
They were the roaring 20s for a reason. It was fun, probably. I mean, no one was afraid of this illegal drug.
But it was a bit dangerous and risky to have.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
So many people did it, I guess it was done in relative safety.
It's just, it was its own system, basically.
Oh, yes.
There could be a raid. Presumably there are ways and to run out. I don't know, did they have back doors to these things? Did that come across that in your research? Sort of, no, you know, well, ways out in case of a raid? Raid procedures that everyone, you know, knows about?
I think there's something like that. That's not in every club, but some of them would have had more elaborate escape routes. Because there'd be some respectable people in society in these places, because apparently it, you saw the mixing of classes, because...
Yeah, everyone's partying, you know. Everyone's... there to do the same thing.
And they have to go to the speakeasies.
But
and they have to keep each
or
other.
Or it's a private party, yeah, presumably. But which maybe there wouldn't be such mingling of classes. But
right. But in the speakeasies specifically.
Yeah, yeah.
The
speakeasies,
yes.
You're gonna have all sorts of folks. Anyone who knows about it can get in, and then the music's gonna be coming from all over the place too. So it won't be this whole, you know, come in through the back door.
You mean for, like, you're referring to when in America and Canada, when black musicians, for example, had to come in through their own exit when they're performing at or entrance when they were coming into the club to play.
Yeah,
was like
in a mainstream club, you know.
Yeah,
a legal one.
Right up to the 60s and 60s in many places, even Canada. But other, in contrast to that, these 1920s.
The speakeasies were, that's an interesting part of it. But all prohibition really shows you is that, you know, by driving it underground, you're incentivizing criminal behavior and you're not decreasing demand. If anything, like, did people, you know, party this hardy when it was legal? You know, like
it's like a golden age of partying.
It's the forbidden fruit. I mean, you just want to have it, right?
But yeah, that's the other aspect that you bring up about being in these speakeasies. Well, there's a lot of romance and glamour that you can append to these.
It's dangerous, too.
There was, yeah.
Not of, just because of, there could be raids by cops, but because, yes, they're run by criminal
organizations
yeah. and by gangsters and the mob. And
all the stuff that came with that.
Yeah, and bought off cops. And so who knows what could happen on any... given night.
Dave and I made an allusion to this earlier. We were talking about rum runners, but between Windsor and Detroit border was a hotbed for rum running, as a general term, or we might say like the northern equivalent of the moonshine runners.
Well, yeah, cross border.
Exactly. It's a perfect spot.
Did they have underground? How did they do it?
Well, they drove across. Sometimes they would drive across when it was frozen, when the lake was frozen.
Right.
They just go across the border surreptitiously.
Okay.
But anyway, what I learned just now about rum running in Windsor, Ontario, is that it made the speakeasies just flourish. It says by 1928, this is a Wikipedia article on this, there were from 16,000 to 25,000 speakeasies and clubs in the Windsor-Detroit area.
Yeah.
16 to 25,000.
I know, it's mind-boggling. I mean, both sides, it was booming. But yeah, I just, really, people must have been coming from all over.
These speakeasies were located anywhere from the slums to the most prestigious neighborhoods. But, you know, it brought along with it, as you were saying, police bribery and... side gambling that went along with it.
Yeah, well, you know, this is it's being run illegally. What happens, just like with prohibition now, by making all sorts of different substances illegal, you're putting it into the same, you know, system, dark side of our globalized system. We didn't have, did we have prohibition in Canada?
Yes, actually, that's a good question. Yes, there was some in some places for short amounts of time.
Yeah, I think Toronto, actually. Yeah, we did have it briefly. Because I went to, there's a club called The Sidecar in on College. I think it's closed now, but I went there. I'm pretty sure it was there. And upstairs, there was a former, I'm trying to remember if it was a temperance society or a speakeasy, but one or the other. It had that history going on there.
Okay, so your question about did we ever have prohibition in Canada is, according to Wikipedia, yes. From 1918 to 1920, nationally, as well as in most provinces, including Prince Edward Island, which had a prohibition ban on alcohol from 1901 to 1948.
47 years, and only for a year in Quebec.
I like how in Quebec, it only lasted a year, but what they're actually saying, it only lasted a week.
Yeah.
You know, 1919 to 1990, and like really it was 4 days long.
It was, yeah.
They were like, sacre bleu, fuck that.
Vive la bière.
Of soil consisting partially of decayed vegetable matter and found in wet, boggy areas. For centuries, dried peat has been used as a fuel and heat source in places where alternative fuels weren't available. Peat was crucial to Scotland's early 19th century distillers and continues to be used today to give whiskey its traditional flavor. The predominant component of peat is a type of moss called sphagnum, which gives a characteristic sort of rubbery smell, especially when burned. But not all peated whiskies taste the same. The terroir, or the environment in which the peat originated, will lend itself to the whiskey's final taste.
Dave, like you were talking about, you prefer bourbon over, say, scotch. But so what about, I'm curious about Scottish whiskey, because I haven't really partaken?
Indulged. Now Scottish whiskey is a don't get me wrong, it's a beautiful and almost like a little more accessible whiskey. Let me explain why. Because the distinct flavor of the Scottish whiskey comes not from the grain, but from the water. And the mosses and the peat that grows in the rivers from which they make the water. So it imbues the whiskies with a earthy, herbal, you know, the dinner of the rabbit and the deer. And they're like super strong and happy in Scotland, like so much whiskey. And if they have it with these flavors, and like if you think about the wormwood affecting the absinthe and giving it an extreme effect, and you think about the mezcal worm taking the Mexican mezcal distillers on trips and taking the gringos on like a trip that's in their own head. When they drink the little green caterpillar, they drop it or whatever worm they found on the floor of the factory. And then you think about Scotch, you think about the moss and the active ingredients in those peat mosses with like the blood and sweat of Sir Robert Bruce and a 10,000 years of river water and flavor and the psychoactive experience that the moss gives to the whiskey. It's very similar to the wormwood and the absinthe and the worm inside my bottle of cheap tequila and the princess who kisses that frog and then gets so high that she thinks it's a man.
You are listening to The Kaleidoscope Gallery. The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
What do you think Charles is drinking tonight? You don't think he has like the special king's barrel, like for like 10,000 year old?
Gin is Britain's favourite spirit. We bought over 47 million bottles of it in 2017. Distillation goes back to the 9th century when Arabian alchemists developed the alembic still. This produced highly alcoholic spirits, which could be infused with various herbs and spices, and which were, at first, seen strictly as medicine. When distilling spread to Europe, it was through the usual havens for medical knowledge, religious houses. By 1269, Dutch monks were producing a special juniper-based spirit said to cure the plague. This was the birth of what we now call gin.
I think on our list of main liquor types, which is brandy, vodka, absinthe, gin, rum, tequila, and whiskey, the only one we haven't talked about is gin.
The queen is made of pure gin. She drank gin for breakfast.
Well, gin seems to me to be a quite, it's not exclusively a British drink, but it's certainly very popular in England, actually, and there's quite a lot of gin made in England. And it's an alcoholic drink that derives its predominant flavor from juniper berries. And a lot of other kind of like spices and floral and botanical herbal flavors mixed in there, right?
Well, I think it was a way to disguise like really low-end liquor. And it was originally a drink that was only enjoyed by the commoners. You know, like they have the posh and the fucking rabble, or what's the other side? Anyway, it was the other side that drank the gin. But that also makes me think that's why the queen says she drinks gin for breakfast, to say, I'm with you with the common people. I could be drinking Armagnac from our neighbors across the street, but no, I'm drinking the bathtub gin that James down on Downing Street made in his backyard and then squeezed like 12 herbs and spices into it and said it's a classy drink. But really it's just like rubbing alcohol. But I actually like a good gin is nice. The problem with gin, like Toronto, for those listeners who don't know, we're based in the metropolis of Toronto, the third biggest city in North America after. But and then Toronto, as I was starting to say, went on a craft gin binge, like just in the mid-20-teens or whatever we call that. And all these gin distilleries opened up. They were super fancy and you could have like gin tastings and, you know, like they'd bring out like a pizza tray filled with glasses of gin, which always impressed me. I forget what they call those. Anyway, when the pandemic hit, the gin distillers thought it was a good idea to switch to making hand sanitizer in their beautiful copper gin stills. Like, oh, this is going to be appreciated. We're going to just turn this into like garbage hand sanitizer.
Like it's like a war footing.
Yeah.
To convert all the factories to fight the war.
But the whole point of like craft distillers of gin is that you wanted to feel like it was a gin only facility, but they were making industrial hand sanitizer. And sure enough, at the end of the pandemic, Not one of them survived. Not one of them came back.
That's interesting because you're talking about the craft aspect of it, because this here intrigues me. Popular botanicals or flavoring agents for gin, other than juniper, include citrus elements such as lemon and bitter orange peel, or spices like anise, angelica root, cardamom, pine needles, licorice root, saffron, it goes on, grains of paradise, nutmeg. Quite complex.
It almost sounds like terpenes, doesn't it? Like the terpenes in marijuana are like citrusy and piney. And are we getting to some kind of truth about why you get different buzzes from different alcohols? The same way you get different buzzes from different strains of weed, and they all come down to the infusions of plants that might interact with the core drug to provide a different buzz, right? So if you've got limonene in your doob this morning, you're going to have like a really creative high. But if you have pinene in your doob, maybe you're going to like, you know.
Wait, pinene? Are these?
As a marijuana connoisseur, you must know. And the combo is like certain ones you need for certain things. But now that you mentioned the infusions in gin and how they pretty much align with the terpenes in weed, I start to think that like the interaction of the infused plants plays a role in the effects of the particular potion.
Terpenes are highly aromatic, tasty oils that are produced by cannabis alongside cannabinoids like THC and CBD. Though terpenes are being studied closely for potential health benefits, and we have some idea how different terpenes might make you feel, way more research is needed. There are hundreds of terpenes found all over in nature. The cannabis plant produces dozens of them, and a few are especially common in strains today. First, there's myrcene. It's the most abundant terpene in modern commercial cannabis. It smells earthy and herbal, like cloves, and is found in mango, lemongrass, and thyme. It's commonly believed that myrcene may promote sleepiness and muscle relaxation, although more research is needed. When you pick up citrusy aromas in cannabis, one thing you might be smelling is limonene. It's also found in lemon rinds, orange rinds, and rosemary. Limonene is commonly believed to provide uplifting effects and is also being studied to see if it helps with anxiety. Then there's pinene. It's the most common terpene in nature, found in pine needles, basil, dill, and a lot of other herbs. It's not that abundant in cannabis and almost never dominant, but you might know it's there thanks to its strong piney aroma.
Some people believe that terpenes will affect or enhance the high a person gets from using cannabis. This is known as the entourage effect and implies that terpenes enhance or alter the effect of THC in the body. But you're suggesting this is also the case for alcohol.
Yes, I think that is what I'm suggesting. And maybe I'm not the first to have thought of it, but it was actually you who inspired me when you were reading out the infusions they put in gin and how similar they are to the terpenes. Like when you buy marijuana from the Ontario government, they tell you which terpenes are in which weed. So cannabis is almost the mother of all plants. But somehow those terpenes also activate inside the alcohol to create the different buzzes we get. But it feels... I feel like we've stumbled into some that definitely demands a little more research, this whole idea of terpenes and alcohol.
But it's interesting that cannabis plants have the highest concentration or among very high terpene levels.
You're not finding a lot of terpenes in your hard drugs, though. No one's saying that the giant line of cocaine I just did had a remnant of pinene. But we shouldn't talk about liquor without mentioning it is a
volatile.
It's a dangerous thing. Yeah, it can be, can destroy lives. It needs to be respected. If abused, it will take you out. Yeah,
beyond a certain point of consumption, too. You can enjoy it, but as they say, enjoy responsibly.
No, I think that's important to say, because we're speaking of liquor like it's a grand potion, but you know, you can smoke weed every day, but if you're fucking getting drunk every day, your life will go down.
Sage advice. Sage, and you're right, I'm glad you mentioned that. Absolutely. We are talking about a rather volatile substance, and
I think it, I should say that if you're young, you know, have a good time.
You mean over the legal limit?
Yeah, I'm saying that alcohol should not be underestimated.
Well said. And the only thing that I didn't get to in the conversation that I'd kind of hoped to, but we didn't, and that was the connection between rum and pirates, and that history, and to other less romantic parts of history.
I think that was purely a result of the Caribbean Sea being like prime pirate zone, because a lot of rum was moving there, a lot of money was being taken from there, and the rum that was moving and the money that was being taken was all a criminal enterprise, like organized by European empire builders, killing and enslaving the populations, ruining their cultures and their lands. So the pirates were like, hey, I don't feel too bad about stealing their rum, or hitting up their rum treasures. And the fact that the Caribbean Sea is a particularly calm and pleasant place to ply a pirate trade. Like, there's not a lot of pirates operating in the Arctic Ocean, you know? The pirate would die.
Yeah, but Dave, that was actually, I just have to say, a good summary of the history surrounding rum. That kind of social history or whatever surrounding rum.
There's a terrible dark side to rum, for sure, because it was... all those Caribbean islands paid a heavy price through those colonizations. They never recovered. Everything I know about the European history from like the time of Christ to 1985 was based on just being drunk all the time.
All right, well, Dave, I have to say cheers.
Cheers.
Until next time.
Until next time. 90 proof.
You have been listening to the many colors of the Kaleidoscope Gallery.